Today is Wednesday. It's December 1st, 2021, and it's 1:35 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. You, once again, I hope, are listening to the Mincing Rascals. If this is your first time, welcome and tell your friends to join us, too. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the victorious and valiant publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter on Substack.com.
And it's just three of us today, not because the others are ill, but because their business has made them unavailable. But Eric, you sound congested.
Yeah, I'm a little congested, but I just want to point out that Brandon Pope is an Ohio State fan, and I was looking forward to this podcast all week to taunt him about Michigan finally beating Ohio State in the big game. And suddenly, about an hour ago, we get a little message from Brandon that he's got a taping with his real job, that he can't make the show today. So here I am in my Michigan wear on Zoom, and I've got my Michigan background and no Brandon to taunt. So I'm actually a little disappointed in him not being here. Maybe I'll do it next week.
Has anyone checked in on where Lightfoot stands on the Michigan versus Ohio? Because she's from Ohio. But she went to law school, I think, at University of Michigan, right?
She's a huge Michigan fan, as I recall. Yeah. I mean,
Eric? I could pretend to be Austin, and I'll say something like, "Oh boy, those Buckeyes! We can't believe we got beat by you, chumps." How about that? Now you can unload on me.
Now you're pretending to be Brandon.
Yeah. What did I say? I'm trying to be Brandon.
Okay. That just doesn't do it for me. I've got to actually feel some pain there. But, you know, the truth is that Michigan winning that game finally after all these years of losing, it kind of restores the rivalry. I think a lot of Ohio State fans, I mean, they would have obviously liked to win, but there is some solace for them, I'm sure, the fact that it's now a rivalry again and the game will mean something. I mean, Ohio State has just owned Michigan for this entire century about.
None of them are my favorite teams, but all is right in the world when Michigan and Ohio State are good, when Notre Dame is good, when Duke is good in basketball, when the Yankees are right in baseball. You know, it just seems like even if you don't like those teams, everything is lined up properly when it's like that.
It's good for the Midwest, certainly.
Yeah, no kidding, really. I mean, that's a lot of folks. Let's start with the jurors who are hearing again today arguments over six counts of disorderly conduct facing actor Jussie Smollett. Finally, a major trial we can all enjoy, because it really doesn't matter that much. The counts for what prosecutors say was lying six separate times to police about being a victim of a hate crime carry up to 3 years in jail and a $25,000 fine. And none of this really matters, except the momentum of things have made it impossible to stop. So now, almost 3 years after the fact, a week-long trial is underway for disorderly conduct. We asked our WGN radio listeners if they think Smollett staged the attack. 99% of them said yes, which led one of my listeners to text, "Looks like Jussie voted in your survey." What jumps out at you on this, Austin?
I mean, I think even the brothers said it was staged, right? So that would be news to them that somebody thinks that it wasn't. What jumped out to me, obviously, this is you're right that the stakes are somewhat low, given that, you know, he could face up to a year in prison, but he has no prior arrest record, really. And it's doubtful that he would seek sort of a severe punishment for this. And there are some states where even filing a false police report is not a disorderly conduct charge, which I thought was interesting. But in Illinois, it is, and that's what he's facing. So I think the most notable thing for me was the fact that the prosecution is alleging that they did a dry run of the whole thing, like as if it was a stage play, like blocking here, like putting tape on the ground, hitting your mark, like make sure you have the rope, all that stuff, which was just so cartoonish to me. But I hope he gets a fair trial, even though it's taking place in MAGA country.
99%. Yeah. How could he get a fair trial in MAGA country? Now, I'm interested in some of the things that are coming out of this trial, including this idea that they had done this entire run through and they have video of the car driving around. I mean, things look really bad for Smollett. And as John points out, at some basic level, this is utterly insignificant. I when I was covering this for the Tribune, I wrote about a case where a couple from Minnesota had come down and they had staged a robbery against them on Lower Wacker Drive, and they claimed they had lost, you know, Louis Vuitton luggage and all this other stuff. And it was all, they made it all up. And they were sentenced to 2 years of probation, maybe 30 hours of community service, something like that. I mean, it was just like, it was one of those kind of slap on the wrist, plead guilty, you know, go and sin no more kind of sentences. This was a much more, first of all, bringing the racial and the homophobic element into this thing made it a more serious allegation to start with. And then you add his celebrity to it, and suddenly you've got an international story. This story was a huge story around the world. And the fact that Kim Fox, and to my mind, what's really interesting about this still, why this case still matters at all, is the way Kim Fox handled it, the state's attorney of Cook County. The fact that she, 18 days after Smollett is indicted by a grand jury, well, I think it was 12 counts at that point, suddenly they turn around and Kim Fox says, oh, never mind, we'll forfeit your bond money. You can donate that to charity. And then we'll take 2 days. We'll give you credit for 2 days of community service for something he did down in Operation Push before this all had resolved. And then he goes down into the lobby of the Layton Criminal Courts building and crows about how innocent he is and how persecuted he is. And it was so incredibly galling to those of us. I mean, I don't think very many people wanted him to be packed off to prison or fined within an inch of his life. They just wanted him to say, hey, I'm sorry, I screwed up. This was a really dumb idea. I apologize, and I will get on with my life. But instead, he's doubled and tripled down on what looks to most people like a really preposterous lie. And Kim Fox went along with it, and that's really what seemed to me to be a huge issue. She went along with it, and then when we asked her about it, we said, well, you know, what happened? Why did you do this? She gave a whole bunch of different answers about, well, you don't understand. First of all, she was telling people, well, you don't understand how the justice system really works. And then it was like, well, maybe parts of the case have fallen apart. We weren't sure we could get a conviction. And she never explained it well. And then finally, a special prosecutor gets appointed, reindicts Smollett and talks about the irregularities in the handling of this at Fox's office. And then at the end of the day, the voters in Cook County didn't care. they reelected her in the Democratic primary, and they reelected, I mean, by overwhelming margins, double digit margins in both the primary and the general election. I'm still wondering what happened, what Kim Fox was thinking, what she was doing, and unfortunately, this trial is not going to resolve that.
I think the other thing that I've been thinking about as this has come back into the news cycle is, I think many of us feel as though there was an initial skepticism of the story, and that was baked in from the beginning, mostly because of that Chappelle routine where he kind of says, like, we all knew, like, immediately this was, something was wrong.
Black people never feel sorry for the police, but this time we even felt sorry for the police. Can you imagine if you was a police veteran taking this kid's police report? Okay, Mr. Smollett, please tell me what happened. All right. 2 a.m., you left the house at 2 a.m. It's minus 16 degrees. Right. You were walking. All right.
But if you look back, this was in January 2019, which was when the presidential race was really starting to heat up and folks were starting to get in on the Democratic and Republican side in the primary. So you can look back at how many people took the bait on this story immediately and really ratcheted up the racial tensions and animus that he was trying to provoke. And there's an amazing thread of all of these responses. So this was after, I think, Kamala Harris was in the race. She called it a modern day lynching. Bernie Sanders was tweeting about it. Cory Booker was tweeting about it. And Lori Lightfoot tweeted about it, saying, you know, this is really, really concerning. She at least did say, you know, I promise the city will have a complete and thorough investigation. But so many people really did take the bait, and it's a good lesson in sort of withholding judgment with claims.
It is a good lesson in that. Donald Trump also took the bait. Biden took the bait. They all did. I mean, the thing is, I think so many people did. I sent a note to John earlier today. I went back and listened to our Mincing Rascals podcast right after the event, like a couple days afterwards, to see how suckered in were we. And actually, we weren't. We were fairly skeptical. We were saying, this story sounds hinky. You hate to say that something this serious might be phony, but let's you know, we were not suckered. So Mincing Rascals, your source for a balanced news coverage. But it's also happened, if you remember, right, not too long after the Covington situation. Remember the Covington students on the steps in Washington? Wow. And all that? And everyone had leapt to damn these students for being racists and so on. And then all and then it kind of realized that the situation was not as it had at first appeared. It was also, though, in the context of the whole Me Too. Me Too was a bigger thing at that point, even than Black Lives Matter. Well, because this was before George Floyd, but it's a year before George Floyd. And so there was a lot of, you know, believe women, believe these accusations. And that was like a theme that was running through a lot of coverage. A lot of the zeitgeist at the time was believe people when they make these accusations. So it felt churlish to say, well, Jussie Smollett, you're lying about this. This doesn't add up. Makes no sense. Why would people be, how could they be lucky enough to be waiting outside your apartment on the coldest night of the year at 2 a.m. and you just happen to come out and want a Subway sandwich and give them a chance to give you a little light beating, which, you know, the one of the things I think is very telling about this is how minor, given that you've got two bodybuilders wailing on you, how minor his injuries were. So there was this whole, the context at the time was, we need to believe these things. We should believe these things. But I think Austin is exactly right that lesson, and it will never sink in because we react too quickly to all these stories. Just to like, you know, the impulse has got to be, wait a second, does this make sense? Does this add up? What do we need to know before we rush to say that Chicago Streeterville has become MAGA country under our very noses? Yeah. Things like that. I think that it really calls for caution and skepticism on the part of not just the media, but everybody, because everybody's in the media now because of social media. So
the state is trying to make the case that he connived with the us and Darryl brothers, lesser players on Empire, to stage this beating, to actually rough him up. I mean, to actually go ahead and tussle with him. And then he would call the police and report that he was doused with maybe bleach, that they put a noose around his neck, that they beat him up. When the police arrived, he still had the noose around his neck so that they could see it. He said, one of the first officers said, you can take that off. He said, well, I wanted to leave this here so you could see it. I don't know how a person would normally behave under those circumstances, but you'd think you'd take the noose off and still make your case. But he didn't do that, so I'm not sure if that was good or bad stagecraft. You know, though, it's interesting to me that in court, at least, you get to defend yourself. And so the defense at this juncture today is saying things like, well, first of all, these two brothers who have said, yeah, we've got a $3,500 check here. He paid us. We went out and bought the supplies, the masks and the bleach and the rope and stuff like that. But they have criminal records, at least one of them does. And when they searched their apartment, they found cocaine, they found guns and ammunition. So these guys have been liars in the past, and they're lying to you all again for reasons that we don't entirely know. But one of the brothers previously tweeted an anti-gay thing at a follower saying about Frank Ocean, why would you listen to him? He's gay. So maybe they did have some vendetta against Jussie Smollett. So all of that just to say, you get your day in court. That's what a defense of this looks like. And while it seems like a slam dunk, the question's going to be, can the state prove that he staged this? It's going to be maybe their word against his.
Is there any chance that details do emerge regarding Kim Fox's office treatment of this case during this, or is it completely irrelevant to
either
sides?
That's a really good question. And by the way, one of the things that you didn't mention, Eric, as you were talking about Kim Fox's handling of this, is whether or not she recused herself from the case. She said, I was no longer involved, but maybe she still was.
Yeah, she said that she was going to she recused herself, but she didn't. If she recused herself, she would have had to recuse her entire office from me. You can't just say one attorney in the office. So it was an informal recusal. She herself stepped back from the case because there were some allegations that she was related to Smollett, which were not true. But she had also been talking to Tina Chen, who was an advisor to Michelle Obama. And apparently people had been weighing in on behalf of Jussie Smollett while he was considered a victim. It was confusing. She never totally explained that either. So, again, I would love to see this whole story told. Maybe someone will write a book about it at some point, and we'll find out what went on.
Oh, no, we got to read a book about this thing, too. Is that what you're telling me?
Oh, absolutely. This is fascinating stuff. And I think one of the things that's interesting about it is that the stakes are low. I mean, as you've said before, the thing, you know, the Kyle Rittenhouse story, which we talked about at great length in the last several podcasts, I mean, two people died and somebody had his arm nearly blown off. That was a very serious, portentous event having to do with, you know, gun rights. And this has nothing to do with anything particularly urgent. This was allegedly some jamoke who wanted to get some attention for himself. So he staged a hate crime and that wasn't even very convincing.
This is a trial. This is a 6-count indictment, a trial over misconduct. Over misconduct. I mean, I'm surprised it's a class 4 felony. Go ahead, Eric.
No, I mean, you're right. But that's what makes it kind of intriguing. And again, the voters have rendered their verdict on Kim Fox's handling of this. They knew about this. Bill Conway, who was her primary opponent, and Pat O'Brien, her general election opponent, both made a big deal out of how poorly she handled the Jussie Smollett case. And voters said, we don't care. I think people are still interested in whether there's a guilty verdict here. I really wish that the trial were being televised. It's very difficult to come to any strong opinion about the strength of the evidence and the testimony because the judge has decided that he's not going to allow cameras in the courtroom, which in 2021 is inexcusable. I had that same feeling this morning with the listening to the arguments in front of the Supreme Court about abortion, which was like they had the audio but not the video. I'm saying, like, what is with these people? It's the modern era, folks. Let's have the cameras in there. Let's let the people listen to the evidence, watch the proceedings. And I really wish that were going on in the Smollett case, because I thought that it really deepened my understanding of the Rittenhouse situation to be able to watch nearly all the testimony and hear all the arguments in that case. So,
Austin, here's an instance, though, where it does matter about Kim Fox. What if they lose this case? I mean, if after all this, they don't get a conviction, wow.
Yeah, and especially given everything else that's going on in the city and in her office right now, we just passed 1,000 homicides for the first time in Cook County since 1994. There's huge, huge, huge issues and people that are having trials that are much more consequential. So the fact that there are a lot of resources being spent on this, I think maybe people won't have an issue with because they think this guy is so ridiculous and, you know, let's try to get him in some way. But yeah, if they lose, it's like a double whammy. You don't get him and you just wasted all this time.
Well, to be clear, this is a special prosecutor who's doing this. This is not Kim Fox's office.
Fair enough.
If there's a loss, it's not going to be against Kim Fox's record.
Who says you? And one other thing about all of this, and that is some of my listeners have said, is there any sort of reverse hate crime? That is, if you say it's a hate crime and you invent this and it reflects so poorly on a city that cannot stand this, then maybe there should be some recrimination for you for alleging that. If you invent that, maybe that unto itself should be a crime beyond disorderly conduct. I'm interested in that.
Filing a false police report seemed crazy to me that wasn't a crime in many states, because that really is. It doesn't necessarily need to be, like, if you accuse someone of murder falsely, then you face the same consequences as a murderer. But those are really, really serious allegations that have far-ranging effects on many people in the city and jurisdiction you're making them in. So there should be a punishment for those things.
I agree with that. I don't think that it necessarily gives a black eye to a city where there were, in 2018, there were, I think it was more than maybe 600 murders, something like that. I mean, there were a lot of murders in Chicago that year. So that to say, like, oh, and also there was this MAGA guy who beat up a black guy on the streets. I mean, that doesn't really, it's hardly a little big mark against the city's reputation for violence and crime. But it does, what I think the toxic aspect of this is that when you file a false police report, especially a false hate crime report, you cast a shadow on legitimate claims of hate crimes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That someone who is the victim of a hate crime is greeted with maybe more skepticism than is appropriate. It's like filing a false rape report or even a false burglary report. It's like when you're filing these false reports, you are damaging a larger pool of people than just yourself. So
one last delicious detail from all of this, and that was the, I think, Megan Kripo's reporting previous instances of filing a false police report. And they told the story of a Canadian couple that came to Chicago. It goes something like this. There was a guy from Canada who told his wife that he got her tickets to Oprah, and he didn't have the tickets to Oprah. And rather than tell his wife that, in fact, he didn't score tickets for Oprah Winfrey, he got a rock and cut himself in the forehead and then told the police that he had been robbed of the tickets, and so he could now go back to his wife with this crime. Somehow or another, this ruse was eventually exposed. And I'm thinking, dude, you've got a lot more problems than not scoring Oprah tickets. If you can't tell your wife you don't have Oprah tickets, and now you're dragging a rock against your forehead and calling the cops. There was no serious consequences for that guy either.
He was found out ultimately when the wife realized Oprah had not filmed an episode in Chicago.
This happened last year. It was this really, really stupid crime. Omicron variant is in California now. That was just reported before we began this podcast today, and it's on its way to Illinois. Dr. Allison Arwoody told me today that 77% of Chicagoans over the age of 12 are now vaxxed, and 1 in 4 5 to 12-year-olds are, and a third of teens here are. But she said it's not a matter of if, but when. The hope here is that the new variant, while maybe more infectious, does not make people as sick as COVID-19 or the Delta variant. I don't expect this to change people's behavior much. Some Republicans are already calling this variant a Democrat tool. Texas House Republican Ronnie Jackson calls it the midterm election variant. Pete Hegseth on Fox and Friends says, count on a variant about every October, every 2 years. And since the new variant is called Omicron, instead of the next available letters in the Greek alphabet, nu and she, Senator Ted Cruz said, if the WHO is this scared of the Communist Party in China, how can they be trusted? What's your principal concern today, Eric, about this Omicron variant?
Well, that it's that what we don't know about it, right? That it's much, that it's perhaps more transmissible than the other variants. I don't buy into this idea that Democrats want there to be more COVID. I think one of the things that has been dragging Joe Biden's poll numbers down is the fact that we're still living with disease, this disease now, heading into the third year, and people were thinking that we were over it this summer, and then it's come back. I don't think that that necessarily reflects well on, even though I don't think it's his fault. I think he's doing what he can, but I think that Democrats would like nothing better than to have this totally in the rearview mirror. So that kind of griping makes absolutely no sense to me from the Republicans. I think the reason they didn't do, they didn't call it the new variant was because
it sounds like NEW.
It sounds like NEW, and it sounds like something. It sounds like a new disease. They thought it would be confusing. And I think, is that how you pronounce the Greek letter XI? That's how the Chinese would pronounce it. I don't know if that's how the...
That's what I'm doing. Because that's the allegation that rather than offend the Chinese president, that we'll go ahead and dodge that problem. And then Ted Cruz, who knows better, just throws that crap out there because he will score any teeny weeny political point he can.
I think the scoring points thing is, I totally agree with Eric in the sense that the criticism doesn't even make sense because it would hurt Democrats, incumbent Democrats, especially the president, the longer that this continues. But secondly, it's the same people talking about how like the science is being politicized and all this data is being politicized. And then at the first sign of something new that no one quite understands yet, they're immediately turning into a political talking point. And it's disgusting. And it hurts people because if this, God forbid, was something that actually was more transmissible, had more severe effects on people who contracted it, that would be horrible and would warrant swift, immediate action. And they would be right to do that. So there was a lot of discussion around the fact that people thought it was unfair that folks from South Africa were being banned from coming into the United States, but many other countries where it had also been detected, those folks were not banned from coming into the United States. And there is definitely sort of an unequal treatment there. But I think I would caution people that shutting down or very, very strictly enforcing international travel when these sorts of things emerge is one of the few things we know for certain that countries that fared through COVID better did. They were very, very clear from the beginning, we're going to be very, very careful about international travel. So it's fair to criticize maybe picking and choosing the wrong countries to do that to. But I think it's one of the ways that you can really avoid a lot of severe restrictions later within your own country is to be very, very strict and very vigilant at the border, regardless of which country it's from.
You know, since we're at 77% in Chicago, which maybe doesn't mean that much. I mean, it's a big area and some areas are closer to 50% and some are closer to 90%. But 77 is the city's number. So I just wonder what else the city can do. You know, when I asked Allison Arwoody, anticipating that it's coming, what else do you have in mind? She goes, just, you know, get the vax and wear your mask, which has been the chant all along. And I just don't see this variant changing people's behavior that much. I mean, how much more can you get?
I would really love to understand the point at what, like, obviously the ideal is 100% of people are vaccinated. That keeps hospital admissions down, that keeps deaths down, ICU beds are open. But what's the level at which you're close enough where there's not going to be a massive, basically an overrun on the hospital system? What's that number of people being vaccinated?
It can't be much higher. I think people they want to take the mask off in restaurants and in stores and everything now too, right, Austin? And I'm getting close to that myself.
It's really, really difficult because obviously there are still people for whom they have conditions that make them really, really susceptible, that even if they got COVID now and they were vaccinated, there would still be a high risk. And those people deserve to feel safe and be protected. At the same time, I do think that there is a difficulty in messaging, especially after you get to sort of 70, 80% of folks vaccinated. You're probably not going to move the needle too much more. Doing so becomes a huge political fiasco, like we saw with the police. Is that juice really worth the squeeze if our goal is flatten the curve, keep hospital resources open, you know, protect people who need protection? I don't think it's a fight that you really want to wage as a city or a state government right now after 2 years.
Would you roll us back to phase five then pretty soon?
Yeah, I think Illinois is actually, I think, one of the few states with a statewide mask mandate. I think you could also maybe devolve more local control, or at least have some people in the state legislature pass laws that make clear what the phases are instead of having our, you know, I think we're on our 22nd or 21st or so executive order.
Yeah, because they're every month, right?
Yeah, every 30 days it's re-upped. There's a new emergency. So at some point, there has to be other voices at the table than just the executive, regardless of which way you're going as a state.
There is a kind of de facto local control over it anyway. The governor said, okay, you got to wear a mask. And in some, not just in some cities, in some areas, they're more circumspect, but it's even more local than that, isn't it? Some neighborhoods or even some stores, you go into some places, everybody's masked. You go into some other places, sometimes in the same town, nobody's masked. And you're not even that surprised walking in. Like, I'm still wearing my mask. Sometimes I'm an outlier. Sometimes I'm with the crowd. But that's just the way it is right now.
I think that will become the norm later. Like, I think masks are probably here to stay and people are going to be more comfortable wearing masks on the L for maybe the next 20 years. And I think that's fine.
Yeah. The question is going to be like when you stop at a gas station and you walk in, and when I travel back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, I stop at gas stations at least once on the way, maybe twice. And just about everybody in Michigan is without a mask. I feel conspicuous and nerdy wearing my mask when I go in. And
well, you are conspicuous and nerdy.
I am. It's true. Maybe it's just reveal. It's a very revealing moment for me. but I am myself. I understand exactly where people are, that I feel like if I'm around people who are vaccinated, and then I feel comfortable in that setting without wearing masks. And it's probably too relaxed, but I definitely have COVID fatigue. I think everybody has COVID fatigue. And I just think that the message has got to get out there. And we've got, the more people get vaccinated, the more people get it and recover from it. Ultimately, as long as, you know, it's such a frustrating feeling that if we had all gotten on board and everyone had gotten vaccinated as quickly as possible and everyone had worn masks when they were supposed to, that we would probably be done with this by now. And the fact that people, it was just sort of out of stubbornness and cussedness that we're not done with it by now is fairly infuriating.
When we have our next pandemic, I don't know that it's going to be much different. I don't know how you would have re-messaged this thing. I mean, what did they not say at the beginning, or what should they have said differently at the beginning that would have persuaded? And I suspect, Eric, you will say, well, it's not what they said, it's who said it. Remember, Dr. Fauci and the federal government did not know the nature of the virus. It'd be nice if, you know, we had hindsight. We didn't. I thought they were circumspect and honest, and there were daily press briefings, and it was the Trump show. Well, I mean, the messenger was the problem, but I think the messages from the true medical sources, I wonder what they could have said differently.
Well, Trump, I hate to keep bringing it back to Trump, but Trump said during those early months of the pandemic that he saw himself as a cheerleader, which is why he said, "Oh, it will be open by Easter of 2020. You know, I mean, he was a cheerleader for the economy. He's a cheerleader for public health. We didn't need a cheerleader. We needed a quarterback. We needed someone who took it very seriously, who had a plan and was going to ride herd over that plan. Yes, did Dr. Fauci not get his mind around exactly what was going on perfectly? Did he say that we shouldn't wear masks when in fact we needed to wear masks? Yes. There was a lot of, you know, science knowledge evolved as we went along. But there was a sense that Trump had that the coronavirus was going to bring down his presidency. And I think that sense, that fear is what in fact did bring down his presidency, that his negligence in handling it, his failure to address it strongly, to get out in front of it and take it much more seriously than he did, and to sound the alarms louder than he did, is what caused the virus to spread. And it may well have cost him the election, that he was not seen as someone you wanted to be in charge during a national and international disaster like that.
Andrew Cuomo is out of his job as governor of New York. Should his brother Chris be out of his job at CNN too? CNN has indefinitely suspended Chris Cuomo after documents revealed that not only did he violate the network's policies by offering advice to his brother on how to handle his sexual misconduct allegations, but now we discover he was also more specifically involved in crafting of his defense than was previously known. You were really agitated or animated about this, Austin, when some of these allegations first started to surface, not of the sexual misconduct of the governor, but of the involvement of the brother. What's your thought about all of this today?
I think it depends on what even CNN thinks, or what the general public thinks that Chris Cuomo is supposed to be. Like, is he being presented as a sort of a hard hitting journalist, or is he sort of more of like a PR guy, kind of cable news anchor type of person? CNN seems to think he should be held to some kind of journalistic standard because they're putting him on indefinite suspension after texts came out, basically, where he was texting comms people for his brother's staff and saying, have you seen this? Have you heard about this? Like, talk to me first, all this stuff. And he was deeply involved. But before all of that, he was having his brother on during COVID talking about mama's meatballs. Like, it was very far-fetched and comical before all of that, I think, and totally crossed the line journalistically, in my opinion.
Ratings were good for both of them at that time.
Ratings were great for both of them.
For both of them.
Homosexuals. I hate that so many people have owned homosexual shirts now or merch, and it's taken on a totally different meaning. I think what they did was right, but I feel like the new details that came out didn't really reveal some, you know, really bombastic or bombshell type of information that would have led to a different decision if they didn't know about it.
First of all, I don't know of any indefinite suspension that doesn't end in a firing. Indefinite suspensions always end badly for the person who's been suspended. I think that, you know, and I'm not one who thinks that people should be fired willy-nilly over minor transgressions. I think this was a major transgression. He really stepped over the line by joining, in a sense, the governor's crisis management team. And that's just not a role that a journalist would play. If he had wanted to, then if he had said, okay, well, I'm going to step away now from my role on CNN, and I'm going to go and serve my brother now for a while, that might have been defensible. He might have been able to work that out with the network. But you can't serve both masters. You can't be that person. It's too much of a conflict. And he should have known it, and he should have revealed it. And I'm afraid he's got to go.
Well, listen to this statement, though, from CNN today. When Chris admitted to us that he had offered advice to his brother's staff, he broke our rules, and we acknowledged that publicly. But we also appreciated the unique position he was in and understood his need to put family first and job second. Close quotes. And I'm listening to that going, no, your job is journalist or whatever it is. Even if you're a provocateur, there's got to be some credibility here. And if you accept, this is CNN's statement saying we understood his need to put his family first and his job second, then that's either a very damning statement by CNN about CNN or Cuomo's got to go. That is a terrible press release. That is really bad language on CNN's part. Let's move on. There's a couple of other things I want to get to you guys before we get done today. I want to finish with the map drawing in Chicago. But since we're on a national sort of overview here right now, let's also talk about the Supreme Court, the Mississippi case. Eric, what's happening? What are you thinking about all of that?
Well, I listened to the arguments this morning, and it seemed to me that there are at least four justices who are very much interested in just dumping Roe and the Casey case that followed up on Roe that changed the dynamics of Roe, but kept it fundamentally intact. I got the feeling that there are at least four justices that want to do that. And it's not clear to me what happens politically if they do that. They could try if they, essentially the case involves a law in Mississippi that sets a 15-week threshold for abortion. Right now, it's fetal viability. 15 weeks, if they were to say, okay, well, we'll accept this 15-week limit and say that women have a right up to 15 weeks, that's even flimsier than the Roe standard, which was fairly flimsy, the trimester standard in Roe. Viability, at least, is a line that may move scientifically, but it is a line. 15 weeks is just arbitrary. It's just one of the things like, well, it's kind of far along, but not that far along, and most abortions happen before that. The question that the justices are going to be wrestling with as they try to deal with this is, do we undermine the legitimacy of the Supreme Court by seeming to be so political? That this has been settled case law since 1971, 50 years. Women have had a constitutional right to an abortion. It's been tweaked, but it's been there. And now Donald Trump gets to appoint three justices from the Federalist Society, and suddenly the court it looks like it's having a political view. It looks like it's being a bunch of politicians making a decision on abortion. And I think Chief Justice Roberts realizes this could really seriously undermine the legitimacy of the court if the court is seen by the American people as just another political body. And if you can stuff the number of people you want on the court, the number of people with your partisan leanings, then you get the result that you want. And that there's no real fundamental grounding in the law, but it's just political. I think they're going to have a hard time splitting this decision in some way that satisfies both sides. And I mean, not that every side's going to be satisfied, but either you say this law is unconstitutional and you uphold Casey and Roe, or you say that Casey and Roe are dead letter, and suddenly this throws the abortion issue back to the states where a lot of conservatives say they want it, and you've got 50 fights in 50 states over abortion. Is that where we want this country to be right now? Do we want to be, I know we're always debating this issue, but do we want to be, this is going to be front and center for the next, for the next decades or more, when as people fight over abortion again? Is that where the court wants to put the country? So it's a really interesting case. That's what I heard in the arguments this morning, was that justices trying to nibble their way around, what is settled law? What does precedent have to do? How does it bind them? And so on. So it's going to be a lot of interesting debates, I think, behind the scenes there.
Yeah, I think I agree. It'll probably hinge on. So Roberts is this institutionalist who very much cares about the perception of the court. And we sort of saw that he kind of had to bend himself into a pretzel during the Affordable Care Act case in saying that, part of it is a mandate, is a tax, not a mandate. But then this other part, we will treat it like a mandate to sort of fit his argument there. And I think the same thing would happen here. I would bet that they do not overturn Roe and Casey. But that doesn't mean that. So, I mean, even Ruth Bader Ginsburg often said that, or had criticisms about Roe in this regard, is at some point it could be like it. I think it maybe is likely that Roe and Casey go away and some other standard goes in. There's just going to keep being these challenges, and it's going to keep being attacked. And that, Eric, to your point, I have no idea what that looks like. And it seems like sort of an intractable problem in that. I know that conservatives want to fight this in the states, but I feel like on both sides, neither side can tolerate a difference between states. They're ultimately going to want to make it a federal standard, because this is not like, marijuana legalization or something. It's like, what is the definition of a human life? And it just seems so intractable that I don't see us getting to a point where both sides don't want some kind of a federal standard and are pushing for it.
I was thinking along those lines. States maybe should get to decide that sort of thing, even gun laws or marijuana laws. But life is a kind of absolute. So how can you say it's a life in Iowa and not in Illinois? That does seem to require some sort of federal oversight.
Well, and the question that they're going to be wrestling with is this a constitutional matter at all? And this is one of the things that was coming up in the colloquies this morning, which was some of the justices who seem very skeptical of Roe and Casey were putting forth the idea that maybe this is not a constitutional issue. Maybe this is not something that is a right. So that if we change it to 15 weeks, we might as well be changing it to whatever you want. Because, or on the other hand, if they do uphold this, if they do decide that it is a constitutional right, that could really, if they say, okay, what's a constitutional right up to 15 weeks, then that pretty much settles the argument legally going forward. But I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think it would sit all that well with the public. One other thing about abortion is that if it's illegal in Missouri, but it's legal in Illinois, you are essentially making abortion legal for women of any means, right? If you're middle class, upper middle class, you can get an abortion, just travel and get one. It is impacting people with low incomes. So it's like there's a real disparate impact of a law like that attaches. So I'm really not looking forward to decades more of abortion debates, but I don't see any way. I don't know if any decision that they make here would solve that. And I don't know. I also wonder whether if they do get rid of Roe and Casey, does this galvanize Democratic voters? Does this bring out when you poll people, you get 66% of the public says Roe versus Wade is a good decision. But do 66% of people vote on that? Do they really care that much about it, or is this what they tell pollsters?
That's what happened with gay marriage, though, isn't it? When states tried to double down on gay marriage legislation, it actually boomeranged on them. Maybe that would happen in this case, too. Is that what you're wondering, right, Eric?
It might. I think that most people, if you probe their feelings on abortion, are okay with it up to a certain point, and it may be around 15 weeks. And then there's clearly a continuum from, the day after conception, the morning after pill, people are pretty comfortable with that, to the day before giving birth, someone walking in and saying, hey, I want this out of me. People are very, very uncomfortable with that. There's a continuum along the way there that a lot of people wrestle with, and there's no, it's tough to find get good, strong moral footing, a constitutional footing on exactly where those lines should be drawn.
Well, I think I should call you out on this, though, because you're unhappy with the justices on the court right now, because Donald Trump was able to appoint, you said, three justices from the Federalist Society. If those had been political appointees by a Democrat, I don't suppose you would have taken issue with the political nature of the Supreme Court then. But because they're not on your side, you're saying, gee, it shouldn't be that way. You would have been happy if it were the other way.
Well, I feel the way that they put Amy Coney Barrett on the court with just a month to go was
that's
was
beside infamous. The point. But the point is, she's a conservative. You don't like conservatives right. on the court making decisions about Roe v. Wade.
Right. No, it's true. I don't. I would like the court to have a much more of an ideological balance. And I thought that the way that that Republicans did that, the way that when they replaced Scalia by waiting what is a year and a half to replace Scalia, I thought that was fine. Means. I thought that was un-American the way they did that.
I know that, but I still think you're arguing a different point than I am right now. I mean, however they got there, they're there.
No, I have the problem with the way the conservatives got there.
Yeah.
I think two of the conservatives got there through essentially cheating in the way I see it, that those were not, they violated the established norms. They were able to follow the letter of the law, but they've applied one standard and then they applied another standard a couple of years later, and voters let them get away with it, just like Kim Fox, right?
I didn't like that either. Okay, I didn't like that either. But if they had gotten there more legitimately without cheating, would you be making this same case?
I would be talking about the abortion issue the same way. Yeah, I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-abortion rights. I think that women should have the right to have an abortion up until the third trimester. And so I would argue it on those grounds. I can complain all I want about the makeup of the Supreme Court, but I'm hoping that they don't overturn Roe. And I'm just wondering what the consequences are going to be politically.
Talk to me about the makeup of the city maps in Chicago, Eric.
Well, the Black Caucus, the African American Aldermanic Caucus, seems to want to hang on. They have, I believe, 17 seats. I wish Heather were here because she knows all this stuff and she's doing her real job. But they want to hang. The African American Caucus wants to hang on to the number of wards that are drawn to elect them, even though they've lost population. And the Latino Caucus wants to have more wards because their population has grown. And in fact, it may be larger now than the African American Caucus. And so that seems to be, that's basically what it's boiled down to. There's also the issue of whether the wards have been drawn to protect people like Ed Burke. And so you've got these competing maps and nobody wants to give. And it does seem to me, as just a total outside observer, that the Hispanic Caucus, the Latinos, have a pretty good case that they should have representation on the council that reflects their population in Chicago. There's going to be, I think, one Asian American ward. There might need to be more than that, but that you want your city council to reflect your population. And that's my read on it. And if I'm asked to vote, which I might be, because it's possible that if they don't get their act together, we'll be voting on a referendum. I think I would vote for the one that I felt best reflected the city population. I'm not going to worry about Ed Burke because I think he's going off to the House of Numbers soon enough anyway. But I do think that the one that best reflects the population of the city is the map that they should be going for.
So just to get into the numbers, you need just a bare majority, 26 of the 50 aldermen, to pass a map that Lori Lightfoot can sign, right? But in order to get a veto-proof majority, you need 34 votes. But even if you were to get 34 votes and Lightfoot were to sign it, you could still have 10 aldermen get together and pass a map that goes to a referendum. This 41 number is what everyone's focused on needing to pat today's sort of the deadline to not trigger this referendum. You need 41 votes to pass it. And they seem very, very far away from it. Lori Lightfoot left town today. I believe she's in Washington, D.C. So it seems like people have thrown up their hands and saying this. They're saying there's going to be some kind of referendum. However, in a few months, they could still cobble together those 41 votes and take away the referendum. So it's not like after tomorrow we're for certain voting on it. They could still do all sorts of horse trading behind the scenes and ultimately get to those votes and pass a map. However, all of this, to me, none of this activity, it's taken up all the oxygen in the room over the last week or 2 weeks in Chicago politics. This is all anyone's talking about at the city council. there's so much political capital going into this and fights breaking out, so much energy, so much time. None of this helps any Chicagoan deal with any issue that they have in the city. It is a complete waste of time, and it helps no one. If the map is if Alderman Marty Quinn's precinct office is in one ward versus another, what? Who cares? This is all insiders doing this behind closed doors. They all have a conflict of interest in even having an opinion on the map. This is like if the Supreme Court was going to rule on the case on how Supreme Court justices were appointed, right? Like you would need to have some kind of, you would need to not rule on a case like that. And it's just so frustrating because there's no excuse to do it this way. At the state level, you have folks saying, well, oh, we got to do it this way because Republicans draw the maps in other states and they gerrymander the hell out of those maps. So it's okay to do it here because we got to counterbalance it. What is the case for that in Chicago for aldermen who aren't even part of a, you know, officially elected on a partisan slate? It's so slimy. The mayor promised in her campaign to pass an independent commission that would pass these maps, failed to do so, has not made it a priority whatsoever. And every alderman engaging in this should be totally ashamed. It helps no one. It's a complete waste of time, and it's only done to benefit insiders in the city.
Is the inference, guys, that a Hispanic can't represent well blacks, and blacks cannot well represent Asians or white people or Hispanics? The fact that you have to carve out by race these districts is or precincts is kind of patently offensive to me. It shouldn't be that way. I understand that you should have representation, but boy, talk about drawing racial lines. I'm not even sure that that sounds all that right or beneficial.
I agree, and I think it's this sort of race essentialism that is sort of ascendant right now. Like only a black person can represent a black ward, only a white person, because the implication of that is only a white person can represent a white ward, which I think most people would agree is it would be a horrible thing to say. And there's, and where does the logic end? Like maybe we should pass a law that only Latino candidates can run if more than 50% of the population of a district is Latino. Like that would just be absurd. And I think it's because this isn't a genuine plea about equity. It's entirely about political power. And if people think that they can expand their existent incumbent political power block that mm-hmm. they can control, they will use a racially based argument to put that forward, because that's all they have to stand on. If they made any other argument, this would be patently absurd. The fact that they're drawing their own boundaries, everyone agrees that that's unfair. But if they make a racial plea and that they're doing it in the name of this sort of this justice angle, it's palatable, or at least not as offensive for so many people.
Right. But if you were to draw just a grid over the city of 50 squares with essentially equal population in each one, starting up in Rogers Park and drawing them down, you would run afoul of the Voting Rights Act, which does presume exactly what John finds so repellent, which is that we have found over the years, they have found that when you don't allow for majority-minority districts, you do dilute their political power. And so once you start down that path, then you can't say, well, we'll do it a little bit here. It's like you're all in when you're doing that. And Austin is exactly right that you know, the Black Caucus has 17 aldermanic districts that are favorable to them. They want to hang on to their power. They're not interested in anything, any demographics beyond that, any social interest, any legislative interest beyond that. They want to hang on to their power and their seats. That's politics. That's Chicago politics. And it is slimy. And if every politician who promised that they would do this, different kind of mapping system, were to be lined up, it would be from here to St. Louis, that you have so many politicians who, when they're campaigning, tell people what they want to hear about political maps. And then when they get into office, J.B. Pritzker is certainly an example, who said, I'm going to appoint an independent. I'm not going to sign a map that's written, drawn by partisan people. And of course, the map in Illinois is one of the most partisan gerrymandered maps in the country. And I say, hooray.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you need to own that. Because
the racial argument, though, I will say, is the implication of that is only aldermen know what is fair on racial lines. If we had an independent commission that was made up of, you know, the United Nations of Chicago, every race, color, and creed that was balanced, they could not have the type of, you know, really special awareness and concern and justice that only we aldermen understand how to do with the Black caucus or the Latino caucus. And that to me is just nuts. It's not true.
I think we're out of time, Mr.
I think we hit all the high points there.
Did you guys watch Get Back yet?
I did not, but over Thanksgiving, my son put it on, as did much of America, and said it was pretty damn good. Did you agree?
I thought it was fabulous. It's breathtaking, actually. Yeah, it's amazing.
One thing that really strikes me is what a genius Paul McCartney was. It is, you know, that you watching them in these rehearsal sessions, there's just something extra about it. I mean, I know John Lennon is also a genius too, and Harrison as well. But there's something really special about McCartney. And I was telling my wife that they reminded me a little bit of the rehearsal sessions that we have for our Songs of Good Cheer program, where I'm sitting in this room with, and we're just kicking music around and chords, and there are several people in the cast who are just way, way ahead of everybody else musically. And they just throw things in, the chord changes and suggestions and stuff. And you just think, like, it's mesmerizing how really amazing these musicians are and how cool it is to watch their process. And yeah, I really recommend watching that.
Was there a moment, Austin, for you where you went, wow, look at that?
There's so many beautiful moments. But one that's very in line with what Eric is talking about is when they bring in Billy Preston, who was the keyboard player for Little Richard, and they met in Hamburg. And he comes back as like a 23 or 24-year-old. And the moment you see him, they're just kind of, you know, futzing around with instruments they're trying to play, because McCartney isn't a classically trained musician. Most of his stuff is just doing that. He comes up with ideas by kind of just playing around. And they bring in Billy Preston, and you can tell they go from these guys who are kind of top of the world, kind of messing around, to having to almost impress him and be on good behavior for him. And he completely changes the entire nature of what they're playing in an instant. And the way that it's edited, there had to be tens of thousands of, maybe thousands of hours of footage that was cut down, and it's done so beautifully. And I can't recommend it highly enough.
A moment that stands out for me is when McCartney is just vamping on his guitar, and he's playing some of the chords that are associated with Get Back, but he doesn't quite have them, and he's playing. And in the course of about a minute on the video, you see him go from just kind of noodling around and seeing what he's got, to getting the basic, the fundamental element of the song Get Back. And it's just sort of watching the gears turn in his head as he's playing. It's really a fun thing to watch.
Hmm. Okay, I'll check it out. You know, you guys watched that over Thanksgiving, did you? Do the break there? Every year, my family had a tradition of going to a movie and going out to eat on Thanksgiving. Well, we didn't go out to eat this year. We stayed and cooked in. And then we thought, well, now we've lost our cinema experience because we were all going out. We didn't go to a theater. So we kind of thought, okay, what's going to be our viewing experience? Particularly since we're all going to be busy for much of the day. We have a granddaughter. The family was together. The whole dynamic is going to change. So we put on The Last Waltz, the doc about the band. And that was a very nice choice for us because it's really compelling to watch. But if you only listen to it, it's still really rewarding. That concert, the final concert by the band, was spectacular. Talk about cameos. You know, when Bob Dylan shows up.
I thought George Harrison was George there. Neil Young.
Yeah, Neil Young. There's a couple of songs that come up. We've watched it before where Brenda just cries. Just cries. For no reason other than it's just such a wonderful, genuine musical celebration by all of these people. All right, fellas. Austin, thanks for being here. And Eric Zorn, thanks for being here. Eric, I hope you feel a little bit better over there.
And, I hope so, too.
The rest of the cast and crew will join us as they can next week. We're produced by Ashley Byhun and Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Austin, you were about to say something, and now I regret doing
that. No, I'm glad I didn't say it,
actually. What were you going to say?
Scorsese was kind of the proto Peter Jackson, because he used, I don't know if you've heard that story, he used special effects to remove cocaine from Neil Young's nose.
Did not know that.
While he was singing on the
Did not know that. Did not know that.
And that's one of the underrated things about the Beatles documentary, is how good this footage is. Nuts. The way that he's reprocessed it is it's like today. You could think it was today.
Was there anything in it that you didn't like about the Beatles that you saw and thought, oh, crap, I wish I didn't witness that or anything like that?
They don't mention it at all, but that was the time when Lennon was developing his heroin addiction with Yoko. So you can kind of see him act like an addict, or just act strangely, more strange than usual. So that was kind of sad, but
otherwise, wow. Maybe someday they'll do a documentary about Songs of Good Cheer, and they'll say, now this is where Mary Schmee came in on the piano. Listen to what Eric does with his fiddle.
Well, I wanted them to do some of the rehearsal, some rehearsal video for this video that we're doing next week, but they just couldn't get that together, because the rehearsal sessions are really interesting, I think. I'm just blown away by how brilliant the people we play with are. See ya. Bye.
See ya.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.